The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Edinburgh Books Podcast. After several days in the world of modern fiction, we turn our attention to medieval poetry, as mediated by two of our most intelligent poets. Patience Agbabi and Lavinia Greenlaw are both up here at the festival with adaptations of Chaucer. Agbabi's Telling Tales is an edgy new version of the Canterbury Tales, while Greenlaw's A Double Sorrow is a retelling of Troilus and Criseyde, one of the very greatest stories of doomed love. Let's start with one of the Canterbury Tales, as retold in 2014.
This is from the prologue Grime Mix by Harry Bells Bailey. When my April showers me with kisses, I could make her my missus or my mistress, but I'm happily hitched, sorry homegirls, said my vows to the sound of the bow bells, yet her breath is as fresh as the west wind. When I breathe her, I know we're predestined to make music my muse, she inspires me. Though my mind's overtaxed, April fires me. How she pierces my heart to the fond root, till I bleed sweet cherry blossom en route to our bliss trip this day she goes off me. April loves me not, April loves me. With a passion, dear doctor, I'm word sick, and I got the itch like I'm allergic. But it could be my shirt's on the cheap side, serenade overnight with my peeps wide. Nothing like a liqueur, an elixir, over proof that she serves as my sick cure. She's as strong as a ram, she is Aries. See my jaw-dropping jeans, she could wear these. See my jaw-dropping neat Anglo-Saxon. I got ink in my veins more than Caxton. And it flows hound to mouth, here's a mouth feast. Verbal feats from the streets of the southeast. But my April, she blooms every shire's end. Fit or vint, rich or skint, she inspires them. From the grime to the clean-cut iambic. Rimoyal, rant or rap, get your slam kick.
So there you have Harry Bells Bailey reciting the prologue to Canterbury Tales. And it's very recognisably the Canterbury Tales, isn't it? That the very first line you place it.
Yes, absolutely. I kind of remixed the prologue. So I'm using phrases from the original Chaucer and sort of turning them on their head. So April becomes this muse. And there are lots of phrases people know if they know the original.
And this is something that also comes up in Lavinia's collection, A Double Sorrow. This is a really quite radical, rude boy or rude girl reinvention of Chaucer, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. Although I think the original is quite below the belt. I think people don't realise quite how below the belt it is because we have that distance of it being in Middle English. So the rude bits don't seem quite as rude.
Oh, yeah, I didn't mean that. It is famously rude, isn't it? And you've got all that sort of ribaldry. But yeah. I mean, the way that you've made these characters absolutely of the moment. So you have, for example, Ozymandia Reeves doing the Reeves tale, which is one of the rudest poems.
I think what was radical is that I quite often chose a women's perspective, because Chaucer only has three women tell tales out of his 24 pilgrims, and I decided I needed sort of more female voices in it, so tit for tat. Retro Glasto dogs on string. I'm bad dog me, with dykes on speed. Musky, milky, masculine, butch owl, femme gen, and little weed. Pitch magic mushroom, down some mead. And weed were whizzing off her tits. Gimme grass or die, you shits.
So that's what I meant by rude girl.
Right.
And it's told from the perspective of a dog, so that's the rude boy.
I think by that stage I was really sort of playing around with perspectives because, you know, when you're taking on all those stories, you have to do something different every time. I wanted to create a completely new world with each piece. And it's set in a kind of, you know, different kind of Glastonbury.
And one of the things you've done is you've created a little potted biog for every one of your tale tellers at the back. So you've got Ozymandia, who was expelled from school before she learnt to hate poetry, taught herself Anglo-Saxon and got a medieval studies MA from York University. You've had fun with these, haven't you? And you've got Robin Miller, who tells the Miller's tale, Robin with a Y, who's bolshy, big, bi, redhead, Taurus, Leo rising, part-time barmaid, full-time motormouth, lights performance poetry, wrestles for relaxation.
I tried as much as I could to base the characters on Chaucer's general prologue, but I took quite a lot of liberties as well, and some of the characters just ran away with themselves. But I did set myself the parameter of having them 50 words long each, so they're each exactly 50 words.
You have followed Chaucer's forms, but you wouldn't necessarily recognise it. I mean, there's one of the poems is written in text speak.
It's cases like Rhyme Royal, which Chaucer invented for Troilus. I wanted to honour that, so Macca keeps to the iambic pentameter. It's quite traditional, whereas with the Reeve's Tale, I play around with that form. But yes, I did want to create a few new forms as well. I mean, each poem was written in a completely different form. I love to work with forms.
Lavinia, you have stuck very rigorously to the form, although you've sort of recrafted Troilus and Crusade in your case.
This is not a translation or even a version. I think, if anything, you'd call it an extrapolation, because I use these phrases or images to tell moments in the story, but they could be kind of 200 lines apart. So I've made completely free in terms of structure. But I think, like Patience, I'm really drawn to form. And using a version of his Rhyme Royal, this seven-line stanza that he invented for Troilus and Crusade, gave me a sort of anchor and structure within which to work. I mean, I don't stick strictly to the rhyme scheme, because the rhyme scheme is A, B, A, B, B, C, C. So there's that odd fifth line that throws everything out of whack, or turns you back on yourself, or shovels you forward. And so I've rearranged that pattern within each of these, because I felt it would weigh too much to stick to it strictly, given the kind of distilled language I was using. I didn't have the texture of language to push back in the way that Patience has. You know, so you've got very strongly textured language, it can push back against the form. Yes. Whereas I felt I didn't want the walls of the form to be built too solidly, because the language I knew, the voice of this, was going to be very much lightened.
But give us an example.
I really went with what struck me, what attracted me, what compelled me when, as I worked my way through these 8,000 lines, and my book is nowhere near 8,000 lines long. And there would be these tiny images, which most of which aren't original, which Chaucer has borrowed from Boccaccio, and this is a story that's been handed down and shifted shape for centuries. When Troilus has fallen madly in love with this woman, he has no idea what to do with his feelings and no idea what to do, because she is a complicated figure that he shouldn't rightfully be courting. And there was this very small image that, when he was filled with doubt, hope would breed in his mind like fawns. So I got hold of this idea of the way that we might fill our head with wishful thoughts in the shape of fawns. So none of these lines in this little poem I'm going to read come from Chaucer, but the image does, and I've sort of exploded it into a seven-line rhyme royal. If he ever fears he might not win her, he falls into some inward place of trees, refusing any path that does not make of itself the right answer. Hope will emerge like a gentle creature drawn from green shadows to steady his gaze. A fawn, soft in the wild, followed only by more of its kind.
It takes a while. You have to just let it soak in a bit, don't you? This is an extraordinary cycle which takes you through a huge emotional arc. It has this amazing erotic bit in the middle of seven poems which describe them spending a night together. I thought that was a really extraordinary, sustained piece of writing. Reminded me a little bit of Carol Ann Duffy's Rapture, actually.
Right. One of the things that's very compelling about this story is that, because Chaucer was dramatising courtly love, he was breaking down a very complex series of steps and rules and codes. And in breaking them down, he sort of activated the psychology behind the story, which hadn't happened before. And so it's very incremental, and everyone is feeling several things at once. And even in the middle of the book, where they have this first night together, they're immediately thinking, it's not just a sort of simple moment of at last we are together, it's at last we are together, is this true? Are you who you say you are? Should we be doing this? What's going to happen next? And I recognised that, and I thought, this is really how we are. We never feel one thing for a sustained period of more than a moment, really. And usually we're feeling sort of in love and hungry and a bit embarrassed, or, you know, several things at once. The book has a classic form of dramatic tension in that it's set in a besieged city. It's like, you know, Towering Inferno or something, it's set in a burning building. It's, there's a war and there are walls all around you. And these people are trapped in this social construct as well. And so in that moment when they are together, I felt that they were in an entirely other place, and it was a place of sort of pure abstraction, escape from all these walls. I use the image, as Chaucer does, of walls again and again. And in this place, there are no walls, and it's simply a number of sensations, really, particularly to do with touch.
One of the characters that's most famous, that most lot of people would know because the name has passed into the language, is Pandarus.
Chaucer took him from Boccaccio. This is the figure who, in Boccaccio, was a cousin, and Chaucer made him an uncle, which I thought was quite interesting. He's Crusade's uncle. It makes him a rather more disturbing figure, because what happens is he comes across Troilus sort of pining away, and he's somebody who's seems to have no important role. He's known for being disastrous in love, and he's going to get his kicks, essentially, out of bringing these two people together. And he's totally ruthless about this. And not only is he ruthless, but he's faithless. So when the point comes where Crusade is going, in an exchange of prisoners, be sent over to the Greeks, he just says, move on, leave her behind. Having kind of courted Crusade on Troilus' behalf and got her to, compelled her really, and then tricked her into being seduced and sort of worn her down. He then, as soon as he realizes that he, Pandarus, has nothing more that he can manipulate, wants to set her aside. And in the end, he just wants to set the whole thing aside. It's just a game for him. So this idea of pandering, of being a procurer, I mean, the first thing he does is go to her house and say, she's in a very tricky position. She's the daughter of a traitor. She's not your conventional romantic interest. Nobody's quite sure of her age. She's been married, so she's not this virginal maiden. She is extremely beautiful, but in a way that alienates people. She seems fundamentally isolated. She is very, very much somebody who seems to naturally find themselves alone. And Pandarus prays on her. He goes to her and says, this great good news, this prince loves you. You know, how lucky are you? And immediately, if you do not respond to his love, he's not offering her marriage, he can't, she's not quite good enough for marriage, but if you don't respond, he will die. And if he dies, I'll have to kill myself, because it will all be my fault. And he says all that in one afternoon.
It's almost like these are two different poets, aren't they? The Chaucer of Troilus and Crusade and the Chaucer of the Canterbury Tales. The one thing that unites them is there's lots of sex.
I'd say there's certainly similarities in the Knight's Tale, which is very much, again, the whole courtly love thing, although there's a sort of terrible twist of two men in love with the same women. And the Knight's Tale was written, I think, just after Troilus, but before he actually began the rest of the Canterbury Tales. And I would argue that it actually ought to stand alone, you know, because it's in several parts, it's protracted, it's complex. I don't think it kind of fits with some of the other tales.
You come from very different traditions. Patience, you've emerged through the performance circuit, London performance circuit, although you grew up in North Wales, didn't you? You're of Nigerian parentage, grew up in Wales and emerged through the London performance circuit. Somehow, yes. Found time to go to Oxford.
Yes, I mean, I did a very traditional Oxford English degree where I sort of did a special paper on Chaucer, so I've sort of been into Chaucer for a very, very long time. Even, to be honest, I got into Chaucer when I was doing my A-levels, And I think I was always attracted to the fact that in Chaucer's day, you know, they didn't sort of make that massive distinction between page and performance. You know, the Canterbury Tales is actually designed to be both listened to and read, and that really appealed to me very early on. So I think if it weren't for Chaucer, I probably wouldn't have become the sort of writer-performer that I have.
And Lavinia, this is your fifth collection, and you've done opera librettos, you've done all sorts of other things apart from, you've got a Wellcome Foundation Fellowship at the moment, you've been poet in residence at the Science Museum, but you also have come through the sort of more conventional poetry route. You've been shortlisted for all the big poetry prizes, for example.
To really simplify it, I probably come out of an English language lyric tradition, but I've also always kind of done things and responded to things that aren't part of that. I mean, we're all cast in a certain kind of place on the poetry map. But I think when you talk to us us. we don't cast ourselves as that. And for instance, Patience and I, we've known each other a long time and admired each other's work for a long time. And there are a lot of affinities, which if people just glance at the page, they may not see. But the way we think about language and image and craft will be very similar, I think.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
My original Wife of Bath was written in 1998. I don't know, a few books happened and then I was made Canterbury Laureate completely out of the blue, and I'd been umming and ahhing about writing a few more tales up, and suddenly I was Canterbury Laureate and had to write a few tales.
This Wife of Bath is one of my favourite characters. Will you give us a little blast of the Wife of Bath?
This poem is called What Do Women Like Best? My name is Mrs. Alice Ebi Buffer. I come from Nigeria. I'm very fine, isn't it? My next birthday I'll be 29. I'm businesswoman. Would you like to buy some cloth? I've all the latest styles from Lagos, Italian shoe and handbag to match, lace, linen and dash wax. I only buy the best and I'll travel first class.
To me, I grew up in Nigeria. I just sort of saw that and just thought, yeah, I know this woman. How did you find her?
Chaucer's original has this sort of heavy, this big cover chief and this gap-toothed smile, and I actually knew somebody who looked like that, so I kind of modelled this on somebody I kind of knew, but I added loads of bits in as well. She's sort of a composite of Chaucer's original and Nigerian market women I've come across. With that tale, it was a question of staying quite close to Chaucer, actually. There's some specific lines that I'd almost translated, but just changed into Nigerian English. And it was fun for me working with Nigerian English because I'd never written in that style before, even though that's my parental background.
There are quite a lot of references to living poets as well, Patience, in yours. For example, mm-hmm. you have one written, the one I mentioned before, written in text speak, which is by somebody called Monkey A. Puzzle, mm-hmm. who's a crossword creator for national newspapers, may even work for The Guardian. You took the idea partly from Carol Ann Duffy's quote, "The poem is a form of texting."
Yeah, I really like that quote. I'd come across it a number of years ago, and sometimes when you're writing, it's amazing. All these things kind of come together at the same time. I did want to celebrate living poets as well as dead ones. There were quite a lot of references not everyone would necessarily get. I mean, like Roger, the cook Roger of Ware, for example, it's a really below-the-belt tale, but it's totally based on John Skelton's The Tunning of Eleanor Rumming, which was, I don't know, written in about, I don't know, 1450. It's about the pub and what goes on. And I really love the style of the Skeltonics, and so wanted to sort of replicate that. So although it might seem to be really modern, it's actually quite medieval.
I mean, I've buried lots of things in my book, quotes from other poets, old poets and so on. And they arise. I mean, Ezra Pound had this thing about allusion where he said something on the lines of, you should either name it or bury it. And so you should say so-and-so says, or it should just be completely.
Now, Jeremy Paxman, who made a very outspoken statement after judging the Forward Prize, might say, you're talking to each other, where's the place for the public in this?
That comes from such a strange understanding of what poetry or reading are, and I don't know. I think it suggests a kind of anxiety about poetry as an art form, actually.
Poets should just write to the best of their ability, full stop. It doesn't. It's not about subject matter. It's about how they use words. And yes, I mean, I think it was good he brought up the issue of audience. For some poets, it may be an issue that they, you know, if they want to reach broader audience and they're not, there might be a frustration in that. There might be a reason for that. But ultimately, I mean, you write for yourself, really. I mean, with this book, I was very aware that I did want to bring a wider audience to Chaucer. I love the original. I really wanted to celebrate what poetry can do and what Chaucer's original did, which is why I decided to do it with poetry. So I was aware of trying to reach a wider audience.
You write what you write. You don't think, I want to write something that's going to be read by X, Y or Z. And you learn how to turn it outwards and to make it something other people can find their way into and connect to. This book is a lot simpler than some of my work. That was its nature. That was my intention in terms of wanting to tell the story clearly.
Let's just go into the poems a bit. This poem, 100 Cars. There's the issue. How do you pronounce text speak?
I mean, I call it 100 characters.
100
so
characters.
So I enlarge the word when I'm saying it.
How do you read this? Like, I don't understand what equals O, ampersand O, chevron.
Well, the motorbike. Isn't that the motorbike sign?
It's the motorbike.
The
speed limit on his...
On his motorbike.
So
it looks like a motorbike.
It looks like a motorbike.
Now you've said it.
I totally get it. But
I am interested in text speak. I don't really. Ironically, I write very formal texts myself. I don't use abbreviations. But I was fascinated. I went online. I found this kind of translation website, and I started playing around and seeing what was available. I mean, I don't think most people who text would necessarily use all these words.
But if you were to read it aloud, it would be a totally different experience
than if
you were to read it on the page, which I think is also really interesting.
Yes, of course. But I think. I mean, you don't have to understand every word. You just need to sort of get a sense. I mean, like, life is L-Y-F, apparently, in text speak, which was the medieval spelling of life. So there were a few nice little crossovers there. So I was really sort of playing, I think. And actually, I didn't really care if some people didn't get it. I've had friends say, I don't understand any of this. It's total nonsense to me. I'm like, OK, fine. But maybe a 15-year-old would understand it. And that's great.
And Lavinia, there's a lot of compression. You've mentioned, touched on this in yours. And I mean, some of it's really beautiful what you've done. So, for example, you actually reference them very closely. So you can actually check what the lines are against each other. This lady is as frost in winter moon, and thou foredone as snow in fire is soon, which you make into he gives way like snow flung upon a fire.
As I said, I saw what kind of gathered like static, really, as I was drawing out phrases and images and also steps in the story. So I would know that I needed something to cover a certain step in the drama. I would find a phrase like that and think of what I needed it to express, which was always what Chaucer wanted it to express, but I may be recasting it completely. It was particularly the thing of snow upon the fire. What that's saying is that she is undisturbed and undisturbable because she's not going to be melted by anything. Her life is cold, so frost that will persist. Whereas he is so volatile and fragile that every time he sees her, he goes from extreme cold to extreme heat. So he melts. He's like snow flung upon a fire. And that's that idea that he is taken up and flung, that it's a passive thing, that he's just propelled into this heat.
What you've done is you have explained part of the process of what makes a poem in that one single line by decompressing it and showing us everything that fed into it.
I've become more and more interested in, the calibration of the image, like how much detail do you need in this image? Does it need to be a simile or a metaphor? How many steps does the reader need to get everything they need to out of it? So each time I would be thinking, can this just be an equally short phrase, or do I need to absolutely unpack it and see what's there? But it was a very instinctive rather than intellectual process.
Do you think there is any other poet who could be given this treatment?
One of the things that makes Chaucer so alive to us is that the language was so in the making. And you have that sense of dealing with wet paint that you have, say, with the early English sonnets or something. You know, this he was finding a form and a language. And so it feels very unset and able and open, would you say?
Yes, I absolutely agree with that, because it was a time when English was just suddenly becoming the language at court and the language of the middle classes, sort of moving from French. Really exciting time, and also a time of burgeoning literacy as well. So, you know, going from the oral to the literary tradition, which I find very, very exciting. So I'd agree with Lavinia there. It's quite hard to actually think of anybody else who's quite on the cusp in that way. And maybe that's why he's called the grandfather of English literature, isn't he?
So should we just end with another poem from Troilus and Criseyde? A Double Sorrow, I should call it.
Love on earth. It comes in a thousand forms. A bull rises out of the sea. A swan plunges, a gold rain falls. Or a noble heart perceives in itself divine agency. What else is life? Seize it.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.